culture is a capital seen in this sense. It's not just knowing for the sheer pleasure of knowing. It's knowing because it creates capital.
And it's kind of nice to get cut through as well when everyone's like, oh, they make so much money. It's like, yeah, well, how do they do it? And like, it seems like it's so unattainable, but really, it's really achievable.
Welcome to Think Business Futures. On this show, we take cutting-edge business research, couple it with real-world examples, and explore what's actually happening in business, finance, marketing, and that broader economic world we have to deal with. I'm David Brown, Associate Dean, External Engagement at the UTS Business School.
And I'm Nicole Sutton. I'm a lecturer in accounting at the UTS Business School. And we're looking at celebrity capital. And how is it that organisations or individuals capitalise on fame? And on this episode, we're speaking with Associate Professor Francois Carrière. Thanks for joining us today, Francois.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here and have a chance to share a bit of the academic world of research.
So this might seem like a naive question, but just so we're all on the same page, what makes someone a celebrity?
Well, that's a very important question. You know, it's most people think of it in terms of fame, right? And you have different definitions, but one way to look at it is, when do people become interested in what you do outside of your main domain, right?
Okay.
So if you are a very good golfer and, you know, you only appear in the sports pages of the newspaper, maybe you're not that much of a celebrity. But if your name starts showing up in the other columns and the sports pages, then most people will say that's when you become a real celebrity, when people know you outside of your main domain. You know, it could be Tiger Woods. You know, he will have columns running on him, but in the Wall Street Journal about his economic impact, and they will talk very little about gold.
Yeah, right. And so it's about that recognizability, right?
It's about the recognizability, yes, in general, and recognizability through the media. So the media, like radio and other media, nowadays all the online sorts, of course, they play a crucial role in that recognizability, yes. It is recognizability through the media.
So we're interested in exploring the economics or business models that relate to celebrity or celebrities. So, for example, we're pretty familiar with corporate sponsorship in the sporting arena, for example. So Puma infamously managed to sign a rising talent of a 16-year-old, Usain Bolt. So why would a company like Puma pay so much money to sponsor an athlete like Usain Bolt?
Well, at the time, it was a pretty sweet deal. And so, the Pumas, the Nikes, and Adidas of this world, they have this strategy of trying to catch them when they are not too pricey, right? So a 16-year-old Bolt who runs a 400 meters, which is, not the most recognizable distance when you're a track and field athlete. You know, why would you do that? Well, that was a very, that was an investment. He had potential, he had talent, and of course, in his case, he had already huge charisma. When you read a little bit, there are a couple of books because of who he has become that relate that journey, and it's pretty well documented that that carried him a long way in getting that deal, for example. And he was good, but you couldn't really tell that he would become the fastest man on earth.
What's the payoff? Say, and as what happened, he did become the fastest man on earth. What is the benefit of Puma paying an athlete like Usain Bolt sponsorship?
Yes, that's a very tricky question.
Good.
What's the payoff and how do you measure it, right? It's one of those things where you know how much it costs you, but you are missing that one little variable to calculate your ROI, right? Which is, how much did you get in return? And, you have some intangibles, you have some esteem factor, you have some, why not, social benefit factor. You know, maybe not if you are helping an already superstar, but if you are helping a rising star. And of course, there are some financial returns. There are quite a few studies now that show that the stock market reacts to news of new endorsement.
Mm-hmm.
Just a simple fact of saying, hey, We are Puma, and today we are pleased to announce that we signed up Usain Bolt, right? So the stock market will react to that, not always positively, but sometimes it does.
Do you have an example when it reacted negatively?
Yeah, there are some examples. You know, if you look at the individual cases, when Michael Vick is kind of infamous. Michael Vick is
an NFL footballer,
star.
Yeah, right? Yep.
He was a very good player, and he had this huge scandal. He was basically the ringleader of a dog fighting league in his basement. So
not a good look.
Yes,
no.
Not a good thing.
And so, you know, we lost all his sponsors, right? And then a few time has passed, and he becomes a big advocate against animal cruelty. He makes a successful sporting comeback, and Nike signed him back. Mm-hmm. After initially dropping him 3 or 4 years later.
Michael Vick got to write his comeback story on the field. Now he has seen his image come full circle off of it. Nike, which severed Vick's contract in 2007 after admitted to his involvement in a dogfighting ring, has re-signed the Philadelphia Eagles quarterback, said Nike spokesman Derek Kent. We do not condone those actions, but we support the positive changes he has made to better himself off the field.
So the stock market didn't really react positively to that.
So just so I can understand this really clearly, from a corporate's perspective, if they then sponsor an athlete, or celebrity, but let's talk athletes, then they expect future revenues to rise and therefore more profitability. So in a sense, it's sort of really driving the upside of the firm, because you said earlier the return on investment is likely to increase. That's the inherent logic.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if you look at the stock market, right? So you are really measuring what the shareholders expect in terms of future cash flows, right? And so that's the bottom line. That's just one way. I was talking about how much it costs you, but you don't know how much you get in return. It's just one way to capture a part of that return. There are others, esteem, things like, oh, you signed a big star in these sports, or maybe you just signed Usain Bolt for your track and field area, and then maybe you are maybe more likely to get someone in basketball because a star attracts another, and that's another benefit that's very hard to factor in your ROI equation, but it does count to some extent.
Francois, before you mentioned this term endorsement as well, and so I know you've done a fair amount of work on celebrity endorsements. What is this? And in particular, how is celebrity endorsement potentially different from, say, sponsorship of an athlete?
Yeah, that's a very important distinction. Sometimes it's a bit blurry in people's mind. It's a matter of who needs more of the other party. That's what the difference is between the two strategies. So, if Puma is endorsed by Usain Bolt, Usain Bolt brings more to the table than Puma will to the athlete. But if Puma sponsors rising athletes, which might be well-known to some extent, but if they are sponsoring those athletes, it's a strategy that shows that those athletes need more Puma than they would give in return. So
gotcha.
It's a bit more, when you sponsor an athlete, it's more of a social move. And when you are endorsed by an athlete, which is usually a bigger star, it's an economic decision.
Well, in both cases, you have the organization giving money to this individual, but the flow of, say, reputation is different.
Yeah, it is. When you talk about endorsements, corporate sponsorships, the way to kind of put those two strategies in one basket is to say it's a case where the company or the brand would like to borrow some legitimacy in a new product category or some values that it is lacking for some reason, right? It's to borrow or maybe to buy it for good.
So to conceptualize this, when an organization pays to be associated or linked with an individual, scholars like yourself would refer to this as being celebrity capital.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain this to us?
Yes. Well, it's a new way to kind of understand what's going on. I just finished this article that will come out in a few months, trying to understand the power or the fame of celebrities, but throughout their career, however short it may be, right? And so in marketing, we have the product life cycle since the 1940s. But what if we use that and apply it to celebrities or endorsers. And because, you know, their fame, it fluctuates over their career. Sometimes it just goes to zero and maybe that's the end of their career. Or it just starts to go down and for some reason they have a resurgence, making some sort of comeback after a scandal, for example, or maybe they just fell out of fashion for some reason. And so we looked at this over time, and we also thought about, but what really fluctuates over time, and we thought about the idea of calling this the celebrity capital. And this is based, by analogy, I should say, on the work of Bourdieu and field theory, which is the idea that in Bourdieu's, I'll try to explain that in a few words.
Let's see how we go with that.
We took a simple aspect of the theory, of his theory, right, to kind of understand the phenomenon of endorsements. But one aspect is that what he observed in back then in France, that social classes have a very strong tendency to replicate themselves throughout generations. How is that? One of his ideas is that an explanation is that the upper classes, the elite, tend to create some codes that they share with, their children, they share with their family members, and those codes constitute a certain cultural capital. So that's why, and it's not about trivia, huh? It's about very specific parts of cultural knowledge. You know about music, classical musicians, you know about expensive wines. Maybe it's not just good for knowing how to enjoy life. Maybe it's good to know to send the right signals to the right people when you meet them. And so that's his idea, right? So culture is a capital seen in this sense. It's not just knowing for the sheer pleasure of knowing. It's knowing because it creates capital. And this capital, which is cultural, I can exchange it because it's like a currency in its theory. And that's what's great about it. I can exchange it for economic capital. I can exchange it for symbolic capital.
I get the economic capital, but what is the symbolic capital that I might be able to exchange my cultural capital for?
For example, you might be seen as more of an expert in your domain because of that.
Oh, I'm going to be more knowledgeable.
You might be assume you are.
Uh-huh,
so that's
course.
What the symbol,
yeah.
Right?
Okay, yeah.
And so, you know, you can derive the different types of capital, you know, political capital. If you have a specific knowledge, you might be able to influence decisions or policy in a way.
But the whole point is that you can exchange
this. But you can exchange. There's a market for it. Right?
Yeah,
you can exchange
okay.
And so what we, you know, in 2019, the media is really important, like this radio station and others. And so visibility now in today's world is also some sort of capital, kind of what we, by analogy, we reasoned. And the celebrities can, just like in the way Bourdieu said, they can exchange that capital for the same other types, economical, symbolic, political. And so that's the idea behind it. But this capital stems from media exposure. That's really the lifeblood of, you know, celebrities.
Can I just explore that a little? So when you do introductory economics, one of the arguments that you start with is, well, you've got labor, you've got work, and you can swap your labor for money, and then that money you can either spend or you can save. And when you're safe, you build capital. So there's very clear economic theory about how capital is built in an economic context. So how do you build or acquire celebrity capital?
Yes, you know, the main way is as a media exposure, you know, in all shapes or forms. It's a continuous presence in the media, right? That's really what's creating, strengthening this capital of celebrity. And that's why is often the question of a good, bad reputation. What's important is just to have a high reputation. And we can see that. I mean, you know, I've run lots of studies over the years. Celebrities with edgy personality and would, you know, have a very high success, will be able to exchange their capital against very handsome, sometimes economic capital.
You're listening to Think Business Futures. To download the show, head to 2SER.com or your favourite podcasting app and look for Think Business Futures. On this episode, we're talking about celebrity capital and looking behind the glitz to understand how people and organisations capitalise on fame, cool and influence. Now, Francois, before you mentioned that celebrity capital really relies on that the lifeblood of it is media exposure, which is a really nice segue to what I want to talk about in terms of with the help of the internet, with social media, with smartphones, we've seen the emergence of a new breed of celebrities, so-called influencers. So who are these people and how do they differ from more typical celebrities like sports stars or pop stars?
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very strong phenomenon. Lots of companies are investing in those influencers as opposed to more mainstream or classical celebrity endorsers. And the reason for that is, old-fashioned marketing. Targeting, that's very important because if somebody has one of the most well-read blog on something really specific, the best coffee in town, for example, where can you find it? You know, read my blog. And because, guess what? It also changes all the time. It's not like you can just read it once because new coffee shops pop up all the time. Mm-hmm. So that's very targeted. And you will have an audience of coffee lovers and so on that maybe the traditional mainstream celebrities won't be as good at. It will be a more mass targeting. And so in a way, to simplify it, we can think of, the new media tend to be to have a lower cost and more focused targeting. And so that's what influencers represent. And the endorsers are more in the old world media, right? So mass media.
Yeah, okay. So our traditional celebrities rely on traditional media like, the newspapers or magazines or TV or movies or so on. Whereas influencers, the way in which they get their media is curated through social media platforms, which I imagine that they actually do themselves. Is that right?
In a lot of cases. And it's also one important distinction when you talk about marketing communication. The medium is really important, and the type of medium is important, but also is the source of the message seen as being independent from or detached from the medium. If you cast the spotlight on yourself, it's not the same as if somebody else is following you to do that. And so most of the influencers, the model is organic growth, like the audience grows with the influence. By that I mean it usually starts talking about brands from the very beginning of the growth of their fame.
Do they have some kind of level of expertise, or do people, like, back to this idea about symbolic capital you were talking about before, like you say, the reason that you might, an influencer is able to have a targeted market or have influence, be knowledgeable about coffee. Mm-hmm. So are they expected to have kind of a certain expertise?
Yes, that's, expertise is definitely a common denominator between influencers and endorsers. The expertise is a necessary condition, I would say, but it also matters for celebrity endorsers.
Francois, when you started, you made the point about celebrity, and you said, "Well, someone has some kind of domain expertise, a sports person, and then they appear out of that domain in the newspaper or other mediums, and they become a celebrity, and then you can make the transition to endorsement of products." And when we talk about influencers, this seems to be somewhat different, that you might have someone who may not, in fact, be a famous sports person or a movie star, but it's someone who actually just starts a business, if you like, from zero. I mean, how do they build this kind of influence or fame?
Actually, David, do you mind if I jump in for a second? Hello, it's Jason, the producer here. Usually I'm in the background, but I know of at least one marketing agency that deals specifically with social media influencers. I'm going to give them a call and find out how it works from their perspective. There we go.
Hello.
Hi, Genevieve. Jason here.
So I'm Genevieve Day of Day Management, and I founded Day Management back in 2015, and it's an influencer talent agency.
When did you personally start to see the shift in the advertising industry from big celebrity endorsements to more content driven by influencers on social media?
Yeah, so when I started the agency back in 2015, we really saw the digital landscape changing and shifting. I was working in PR at the time. My clients' requests and what they were aiming for was shifting from that traditional celebrity or getting media coverage, and they wanted the kind of local celebrity being the influencer to be promoting their brands and offerings. And so that was kind of my first inkling that this was going to be a really massive shift in the industry.
And what was driving that? You know, was it a bottom-up thing? Was it the success of influencers on social media and PR firms and advertising were catching on to that? Or was it the other way around?
Yeah, I definitely think it started that way, in the sense that influencers or people on social media were just posting it organically, and then the results were coming in from there. And it was almost surprising the PR agencies and the ad agencies. They're like, oh, wow, this person who, you know, doesn't really have any social standing, they're just, you know, the girl next door who's posting beautiful content, they're selling out products. And so that was kind of the birth of the influencer. So it's really interesting that it started from the, you know, grassroots success, and now it's a multi-million dollar industry.
So before getting into the business side of things specifically, just on a general level, what makes influencer content different from traditional celebrity endorsements?
So I think that the content itself can be quite similar. They're still promoting brands and having those product alignments. However, it's someone that's relatable to you, and it's someone that is more attainable rather than a celebrity that's out of reach, which means because it's relatable to the consumer, they're more likely to engage with it. And that's how the content is quite different. There is more of it. I think influencers are posting regularly, and they're giving a behind the scenes look of their lifestyle to, you know, anyone that follows them. When celebrities were a bit more out of reach and not as relatable and personable, I guess.
Obviously, the relationship then has changed between the influencers and the agencies and the brands. How did it start? What was in it for the influencers in the beginning?
Yeah, in the beginning, it was more of like a product or a contra arrangement. I think as well, people didn't quite understand their own value and the own value they were providing to these brands, whether now we are so acutely aware of that, which is why there's a monetary price associated with it. So in the beginning, I think people were happy to do a lot more for free or in exchange for product. But now that we have a lot more back-end data and statistics and a lot more case studies of, you know, the ROI that we have produced for brands, we can then associate the cost with it and price it up as such. So it was interesting back in 2015, especially, people were doing a lot of things for free. And that's kind of why I started the agency, is that I saw a monetary value we were putting in our PR reports for these influencer posts that these people were doing for free. And there was a gap there, whether now it's really hard for a brand to get cut through without allocating spend.
So it's almost like a continuation in the shift in advertising in general, from selling a product to selling a lifestyle, which we've kind of experienced, and now it's just like a logical extension. You're seeing that person's lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that they do sell every aspect of their lifestyle, or they do promote every aspect of their lifestyle as well. They want to be really real and authentic with their audience. And that means that they kind of peel the curtain back a little bit, and they give them a look into their life and into every single product they use and their beauty cupboard, to what they're eating, to what they're doing every single day. And that is very different to how traditional celebrity endorsements were, where it would be the kind of once off sponsored post, as opposed to like an overarching campaign.
Can you tell me, how does it work?
Yeah, so in the beginning, we really scouted out some talent that we thought were going to explode. We're going to really be the next big thing. So it's really exciting to kind of go on that journey with them. And we do try and look for people that has that it factor, yet also a commercial appeal about them. Now that we're kind of an established talent agency, we don't really scout out new talent in that same way. It's much more reactive. And instead, we kind of are looking for opportunities with brands and how we can align them with our talent and with our influencers to have really authentic and longer term, you know, brand alliances. And so we're looking for a campaign approach rather than just a one-off sponsored post, where they can be brand ambassadors and spokespeople and used in their, you know, print campaigns on billboards and transcend just social media alone.
Are there contracts involved?
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of our job, it looks very glamorous and it looks like we're going to fun events all the time, but it's a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of contracting and spreadsheets. So we're always calculating in the agency, you know, the commission that we get, how much return on each job that we receive. And sometimes the amount of paperwork and admin for a $1,000 job is the same for a $10,000 job. So we are always calculating that and drawing up contracts. A lot of it is brand exclusivity. That's a huge thing for these social media jobs and beyond. So there is absolutely a lot of paperwork involved, and having my background in media and communications didn't quite prepare me for that. So a lot of learning on the job definitely took place.
How do you calculate your return on investment?
So for the brand, it's tricky sometimes if they go into it with an objective of sales straight away. We always say what we can guarantee is brand awareness. And similar to normal advertising and traditional PR, it's all about building the brand's profile and awareness to the consumer. And studies have shown that you have to see something 7 times before you make a purchase. So we obviously, if we're part of that 7, a sales will be a byproduct of that, but it may not be the direct effect of an Instagram post. But what we can guarantee for brands now in an ROI is a really targeted approach. Instagram insights and the business profile have given us amazing tools to use that we can see within an audience what percentage are male or female, how old they are. And in that way, we can guarantee a really niche targeted marketing campaign for a brand.
And so you provide them with analytics of the social media posts?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
we also provide a report afterwards that shows not just how many likes and comments a post might get, but the back end data Instagram provides us with shows us impressions of how many people actually saw the post, how many people might have clicked on the brand's page as a result of that post, or in the Instagram story, a swipe up link, how many have then gone to their website through that URL link. So we can give them a lot of data that shows exactly what happened as a result of that post. And then hopefully the sales are the next step, but we can definitely guarantee that, you know, if someone has 200,000 followers, that 100,000 people might have seen that post and then 10,000 people might have liked it.
How do the influencers make money?
So traditionally it was just through sponsored posts and it would be more of a one-off sponsored post with a brand. However, now we are working a lot more with long-term partnerships and ambassador roles, which is great for the business and for the influencer. It also has expanded beyond that, where they might create content for the brand for their own social channels or for their website or EDM. They might host events and do stuff with brands in person, which is kind of great to see that again transcend from online to real life. So there's a lot more than just the standard sponsored Instagram post that people would associate it with. There's a lot of different avenues we can go down, different factors that we can price up and monetize.
Lastly, but most importantly for our purposes, you mentioned that you also work with podcasters. I was just wondering, what tips do you have for the Think Business Futures team? How can we become powerhouse digital influencers?
I love this because everyone wants to be an influencer these days. I think it's great to really understand your niche and who your following is and who you're targeting. So for you guys, there's a massive audience out there of people in business, people in entrepreneurial pursuits. There are so many business communities and groups and think tanks out there that you could totally be targeting. I think as well, you could be putting much more of a face to your brand. Let's get you on those Instagram stories. And I think that kind of engagement definitely grows a channel. So yeah, you could totally be the new influencer and be, you know, the leader in this business space.
Okay, well, we'll have to get an Instagram account started firstly. But
yeah, that's a good starting point.
Thank you so much, Genevieve. I appreciate that. We'll put links to the show notes and everything to the website.
Amazing. Thanks so much for the chat.
That brings us to the close of this episode of Think Business Futures. Think Business Futures is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. This podcast is made via UTS Business School with the support of 2SER 107.3. If you'd like to hear more from us, head to the 2SER website, 2SER.com/thinkbusinessfutures. You can also search for us on your favourite podcast app. Our executive producer is Jason Lequia.
And thanks very much to Francois Carrière for coming in on the show to explain celebrity capital. Francois, will you endorse this episode, perhaps?
Absolutely, absolutely. No risk involved.
Until next time.